The following podcast contains mentions of alcohol abuse, depression, and self-harm.
The town may be kind of small, but these folks have big smiles and big hearts, and they know what it is to have simple fun down our way, where old-fashioned singing and homey gatherings make living mighty pleasant.
On January 31st, 1995, James Dean Bradfield and Richie Edwards of Manic Street Preachers checked into a hotel in London, England. They were flying to the United States the next day to begin a promotional tour ahead of the release of the band's third album, The Holy Bible. The following day, it was only James Dean Bradfield who boarded the plane.
Me, myself and Richie were just supposed to go over there to do some promo for the tour. And when I woke up the next morning, supposed to knock on his door and there was no answer, and I waited around for 2 hours. And obviously we just thought he'd done a Joe Strummer runner kind of thing, you know, just for a week or something. So I went over to do the promo, and it became obvious after a couple of days, after no contact, that, you know, that it was a bit more than just a Strummer runner.
Richie Edwards has not been seen or heard from since.
Keep rolling.
Welcome to Abandoned Albums, the documentary podcast where we take a closer look at some albums that may have been forgotten about over time, some albums you might not know existed, and some albums by some new, or at least new to us, artists we think you should know about. I'm your host, Keith R. Higgins.
The paper doesn't give many details. Tell me about this.
They're a real onion band. You know, if you just want well-written rock with big choruses that you can sing along with, they've got that for days. They've filled arenas with that over and over. But if you start peeling those layers, there's depth there. Interviews and lyrics that draw you into deeper exploration, literary references, philosophy, art, history. They glorified and glamorized intelligence and politics. They sang from the fringes, touching on everything from depression to sexual confusion, and they did it all whilst presenting such a strong, united front that it was inevitable that they would become a magnet for misfits. The characteristics that would have got you bullied at school are the same qualities that they prized. So if you didn't feel like you fit in anywhere, this band, this tribe, offered you solace and strength.
On this episode of Abandoned Albums, we're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to tell the story of the Manic Street Preachers' third album, The Holy Bible. But we're going to do it a little bit differently. So here's Manic Street Preachers talking about the Holy Bible in their own words. Mostly.
The Manic Street Preachers are one of the biggest bands in Britain, but their original leader and lyricist, Richie Edwards, never got to share their success.
Here's singer James Dean Bradfield.
The way we formed was basically just as a matter of just, you know, just being all friends in school. You know, all four of us went to the same school. Richie and Sean were in the year above myself and Nick. And, you know, as we grew older, we just kind of all came together in terms of perhaps feeling like we were kind of a bit nerdish. And like, you know, one band drew us all together, and that was The Clash, you know. And that's kind of how we started, really, just all being Clash fans and kind of just, you know, feeling as if we were kind of, you know, it's cliched, but kind of outsiders in our little community, and we just all came together like that, really. We kind of felt out of step with a lot of the raves that were going on at that time, and we kind of felt a wee bit out of step with, you know, things that were coming out of Manchester at that time. And, you know, in the middle of where we lived, we just felt there was a lot of, well, just a lot of drudgery and despair, really. You know, the miners' strike was going on, and nobody was talking about that in any of the records we were buying. And since we were kind of fans of The Clash, we kind of saw that it was essential that sometimes, you know, bands wrote about, you know, things that affected them. The band was myself, Nick, Sean, and we had a different bass player then, a guy called Flicker. And kind of we did our first demo in about 3 weeks, I think, something like that. And we kind of tried to go up to London and give it to John Peel straight away. And within weeks of forming the band, it was serious straight away, really. We kind of just like targeted lots of journalists that might be sympathetic to us, so we just pressed up our own single and we just all wrote our own letters, and we just focused on getting the manager, basically, you know. And that was Philip, and Martin from Hall & Nothing, who were doing press for the Stone Roses at the time. And we kind of knew that if we seemed like an antidote to a lot of that was happening, one smart person would pick up on it, and that was Philip and Martin, you know. And musically, you know, I felt a lot of pressure when we went into Motown Junk, just because, you know, we were talking about ambitions that didn't quite exist at that point in time.
We just want to mix like politics and sex and look brilliant on stage and say brilliant things. We're the most original band, I think, the last 15 years.
We were being, you know, shameless in terms of saying that we just wanted to sell as many records as Guns N' Roses kind of thing, which wasn't kind of fashionable at that time because the indie ethic was still really ingrained in people. You know, we'd done Generation Terrorists and Gold Against Soul, and, you know, when we recorded Gold Against Soul, it was in this big studio, and it was just like, you know, we just felt as if we'd just been a bit stupid actually buying into that shtick of recording a big second album and just like, you know, and just taking the check and going, yeah, we're gonna have a great time and, you know, kind of eat grapes like Julius Caesar and our fucking big bus and fill it with hot milk kind of thing. You know, we just felt as if we'd become opulent. So when it came to do the third album, Holy Bible, we just felt as if we just had to go back home and just, you know, go home every night and not stay in the studio, not just like, because we felt as if we were just going back home to do it, and we felt as if we were just having a bit of a reality shot, we just felt kind of happy. So even though that album at its core is just really dark and just really aggressive, strangely, you know, when we recorded that album, it was quite a happy period.
Here's bassist Nicky Wire.
That particular year was such a crucial year for us in so many ways as well.
During the making of The Holy Bible, their manager, Philip Hall, died of cancer. The band were badly shaken, and the tragedy deepened Richie's ongoing depression. For the first time, he took complete control of the lyrics and imagery of a Manic Street Preachers album.
It didn't take long to realise that Richie's creative flow was far outstripping mine. And I was just in quite a happy place at the time. Like I said, I'd got married and I'd just bought this little house. It just felt, I'd been living with my in-laws up until then and stuff, and it was just, I had no problems at all with Richie writing.
The Holy Bible is now regarded as one of the darkest albums in rock and roll.
This is the pain of madness. The tears, the hurt. The head isn't there, but the head is huge, and then it's... I don't know, it's very... It hurts.
Mental illness has been with us since the beginning, yet our ignorance far exceeds our knowledge. We don't know what causes it, and we're still searching for effective ways to treat it. We even have trouble defining it.
Rich's frustration increased and began to manifest itself in binge drinking, bulimia, and most dramatically, in public self-mutilation.
Here's Sean Moore.
He started sort of drinking heavily and smoking a lot more, and he used to sort of put out his cigarettes on his arm. But the actual cutting didn't really start until we played in Norwich. We did a gig in Norwich, and Steve and Matt came along to do a review of the gig. And at the end of the gig, Richie sort of went up to him and, you know, started sort of discussing various things, and Steve Lamack sort of brought up the integrity of the band.
Said, you know, I just think that sometimes the way you portray yourselves, the way you look and some of the slogans and the actions don't really show off your depth, you know, and may mislead people, and people might not think that you're actually, you know, for real. And he started on a, you know, really impassioned kind of statement of what he thought the Manic Street Preachers were about. While he did it, as I say, from somewhere he'd got a razor blade. And while he was talking, started to cut down his arm.
Edwards would carve the word "for real" into his arm to make a point, and at the end of the day would require 17 stitches.
People say to me, why didn't you stop him? It happened like that. And I don't know, it was like maybe going to shock, you know, a little bit. But also he was just the presence and just the tone of his voice, mesmeric, I think, probably. So it didn't stop him. We carried on talking until I said, look, we've got to stop this, and almost made light of it, was saying, look, because, you know, you're making a mess of the carpet.
Did you do that for publicity?
No, I just, you know, we're just talking to a journalist afterwards, talking to him for about an hour, and at the end of it, you know, he just basically didn't believe what we were saying. He just sort just hype generated, you know, by a press officer or whatever. And I just cut my arm just to show him that, you know, we mean it. If we want publicity, I'll cut my hand off. I'll get more publicity to get front cover then.
Here's bassist Nicky Wire.
I didn't see him doing it, but when I saw him coming out, I just thought it was such an amazing, fantastic statement. I just thought, God, you know. I almost thought, you know, I wish I had get to do that. I just thought it was brilliant.
Singer James Dean Bradfield.
That wasn't planned that night, you know, but I think he knew he was going to do it, but he hadn't told the rest of us. And for a second you think, no, you know, you think, to actually go through that, it must take something different. It must be a different ingredient inside of him. Because he's way different from me if he can do that. I remember thinking that. Then I remember reverting to the, God, he's cool, you know.
There had been a lot of darkness. I think Thailand was a different level. That was more worrying because that just happened, if you know what I mean. It was a trip that I think scarred us pretty deeply. It seemed more out of control. Richie was always a very controlled person, but it almost seemed just something in his head had clicked. I don't know, a deer, I'll show you, whatever you're asking me to do. It didn't seem like the full real incident at all.
To fans, he was Richie, the colourful figurehead of the Manic Street Preachers. Stylish, provocative, dramatic.
When things got too much, drink as fast as much as I could till I passed out, you know. So then, I mean, for me, sleep is a fundamental part of my day, you know, it shapes my day. I'd like to go to sleep.
He'd always spoken openly about his mental health problems, his depression and anxiety.
Here's the Manics drummer, Sean Moore.
He seemed to be just drifting another way, you know, down a sort of darker path, and we all felt pretty helpless as well, but, you know, by it, you know.
Yeah.
And we just couldn't understand why he was heading that way. Just really sad that, you know, there was a person that was, you know, slowly falling apart, had the ability to do something about it, and the intelligence and everything else, but for some reason just couldn't.
Fanny had given Richie a present of a little kind of ceremonial knives. I think the Fanny actually said, please use them on yourself. And when I was doing my acoustic session, which is the first time ever, actually. It was the first time I'd done the solo acoustic session of Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head on stage alone. And suddenly I realised, I thought, wow, the crowd are enjoying this. They're really going for it. But Richie was on one of the speakers cutting himself up with the knives.
You could tell that Richie's lyrics were becoming unbelievably erudite and internalised. You realise that his internalisation and his just the ferocity of his mind, you know, was just coming out in these amazing words.
Of those lyrics, the great bulk of those lyrics, which made up the Bible that Richie had given me to write the music to, I remember getting lyrics like "Yes." I remember thinking, "You crazy fucker! How do you expect me to write music to this?"
Richie Edwards decided to precede each track with phone samples, extracts from TV or film, phone snatches of conversations. It immediately gives the album a sense of reaching out beyond popular music to a broader cultural canvas.
So I think, come the Holy Bible, the idea of using all these snippets to kind of illuminate and illustrate the words just felt really natural.
You can buy her. You can buy her. This one's here, this one's here, this one's here, and this one's here. Everything's for sale.
I'm
James Dean Bradfield.
Yeah, I remember us. Yeah, that's representative of the way we were thinking at the time. I remember, you know, I think somebody saying perhaps you should do a version without the word cunt in, because obviously Yes was a contender for a bit of a single at the time. And we just didn't even consider it. We didn't consider having an alternate version with, you know, dumb bastard in or dumb pranit, whatever you want to say. You know, we just wouldn't even consider taking the word cunt out of it. So that's just the way we were thinking. We were pretty uncompromising at the time. Yeah. I definitely think, you know, at that time we were very insular. It was definitely us four against the world. You know, a bit of a last gang in town mentality.
Yeah, I think Yes always felt like an opening track. You know, I think it's a really energized, poetic.
Here's writer Keith Cameron from Mojo Magazine.
The diction of the singing dictated the fact that a lot of the words are garbled. You can't actually hear a lot of the lyrics until you sit down and read them. So yes, I can understand how you would innocently play the first track on the album and the torrent of expletives therein might have got missed. It's harsh language, beautiful language in many ways. It's inspiring for a record that's ostensibly in the pop idiom or the rock idiom to be so engaged with language and wanting to use language and subvert language and twist words and, you know, such a torrent of words.
One of the most crucial influences on the Holy Bible was that when we were the last tour of Gold Against the Soul in Germany, we visited the death camps. We went to Auschwitz and Dachau.
Yeah. Both on the same tour.
The 2 days off we had on the tour, we visited those places. That did have a, as it would, I think, to anyone who visits those places, but it, expressively, it had a massive influence on us.
And perhaps there is, well, for us anyway, there is a sign that you're in a truly creative environment or moment where you think you're going to sell lots of records, despite the fact you've got 3 Daft Camp songs on your album. You know, perhaps there is a definition of just of not being aware that you have anything to lose and just being completely and utterly artistically brave. I don't know.
I think we've been exposed to real extremes in the sort of 4 years from Motown to then. And I think it just the manifestation of Richie's maybe is Disintegration was just unbelievable artistry. And there's such a long tradition of that, that because he was writing so much, you just felt whatever happens, maybe that he writes the best novel ever. It might not be that he'll find lyric writing too easy or something, you know. He just felt that his writing had become to such a level and he's writing so much of it that in that sense, he kind of found himself as an artist. It felt like being around a novelist.
The titles of the magazines and their table of contents speak more eloquently than I of the tremendous problem here presented. Sexual sadism, strange flagellation cults, erotic confessions of a sadist. What is fetishism? The pleasure of pain, the worship of the whip, sexual problems of a masochist, famous transvestites. Are cross-dressers afraid of sex?
I think 4 Stone 7 Pounds is one of his most truly terrifying lyrics. Nothing kind of, when I talked earlier about the internalization of himself, I think that lyric expresses it in a very strange kind of way, though, that the security of Richie being in control of himself was less terrifying than like what I said about in Thailand with the knives, where he seemed to be out of control. You could say he's written that agenda, but I think it's pretty plainly autobiographical, especially that amazing line of I've long since reached a higher plateau.
Self-worth scattered, self-esteem's a bore. I long since moved to a higher plateau. This discipline so rare, so please applaud.
Just look at the fat scum that's around me.
Yeah.
Is it?
Keith Cameron.
I interviewed Richie not long after The Holy Bible had come out, and I was really struck by his ability to kind of take a really clear view of himself and to act almost as doctor and patient. And you can see that on the lyrics to 4 Stone 7 Pounds. There's the line, I want to be so skinny that I rot from view. I want to walk in the snow and not leave a footprint, which is actually a beautiful image, but you almost feel a bit of a sick voyeur listening to it. You feel kind of unclean, as though you're being let into some private thoughts that you really shouldn't be privy to.
I eat too much to die and not enough to stay alive. I'm sitting in the middle waiting.
There were songs which were much more traditional within our canon, I think. You know, we just developed our language.
By 1993, the Manic Street Preachers had traveled around the world, and by soaking in cultures beyond South Wales, their worldview had changed. Additionally, the world had drastically changed, as the things that had concretely defined right, like democracy, and wrong, like communism, had a tectonic shift. As writer Rain E. Jones points out in her essay, New Moral Saviors, quote, in the vacuum left by the apparent end of geopolitical battles based on ideology, it was culture rather than politics or economics which became the primary battleground, unquote.
Having a song called If White America Told the Truth for One Day, Its World Would Fall Apart. Those things probably made them quite a difficult sell on a wide scale.
Larissa Woodkey, in her essay, Distance and Disjuncture, Difficult Knowledge, Allegory, and Irony in the Holy Bible, says this. The song, quote, takes aim at American foreign and domestic policy, especially as manifested in its institutional racism. The Manics mock the hypocrisy of American morality and their governing body's belief that they could be the world's savior. It is a track steeped in the bitter dregs of the neoconservative 80s in which the principles of decency were declaring war on drugs and being applied to the lyrics of popular music. Unquote.
Rock music has always been controversial, but in the 1980s, many parents felt lyrics had finally gone too far.
Rock lyrics have turned from, I can't get no satisfaction, to I'm going to force you at gunpoint to eat me alive.
Our daughter was only 7. And she came to me one day and she said, Mom, what's a virgin? Then Tipper, her daughter, bought Prince's Purple Rain. I met a girl named Nikki. Guess you could say she was a sex fiend.
I did not feel that was appropriate for my then 10-year-old child to have purchased.
It just made us angry. And we knew that others didn't know about it, so we just thought, you know, we have to do something.
Susan Baker and Tipper Gore formed the Parents Music Resource Center, or PMRC. The Washington Wives proposed a code of their own, an explicit lyric warning label, which the industry soon agreed to. But the idea of a warning label worried musicians like Frank Zappa.
They may say, we are not interested in legislation. But there are others who do, and there's this fervor to get in and do even more, even more.
In all candor, I would tell you it's outrageous filth, and if I could find some way constitutionally to do away with it, I would.
People have been complaining about popular culture since ancient Greece. There are quotes from Plato about the violence in Greek tragedies and their effect on kids. Aristotle disagreed.
All of that manifests itself on that second track, "If White America Told the Truth for One Day, Its World Would Fall Apart."
It was about just American citizens not actually having ownership of being American itself, just being victims and being scapegoats.
We are caught in a moral straitjacket at times, and that's probably why it was good with having Richie around, because he would break that straitjacket, which you need at times in a band, because you just turn into some po-faced honesty, sincerity, all those things which we are, unfortunately, but sometimes it's nice to have the demon seed.
Next Thursday, you're invited to watch Rising Tide's live coverage of a gala tribute and salute to Ronald Reagan. Host Haley Barbour joins special guest Lady Margaret Thatcher in celebrating the former president's 83rd birthday. Tickets are $1,000 a plate, but you can see the event free on GOP TV.
We all started to listen to the same records. We all started to listen to Metal Box, Pill, Gang of Four. We were listening to Wire. James especially was listening to Wire magazine and Joy Division. Whereas the previous couple of years, we've been listening to Guns N' Roses and Alice in Chains.
I'd been to see Girls Against Boys at the Garage and Highbury Corner, and Scott McLeod, the singer, was such a malevolent presence on stage. And I was just really impressed with them as a band, and especially him. So I went and bought a couple of the records, and this is a song that I really latched onto. And I think they had a small bearing in some of the music I wrote for the Holy Bible.
How do you feel about the future with Mammoth Great Preachers?
Future? It's a big nasty word, isn't it?
And for us, it was just like a simple decision of us perhaps trying to be method musicians as opposed to method actors. On the second album, Gold Against the Soul, we recorded in the big, kind of Mock Tudor mansion in Surrey somewhere, I think. And we felt as if that rubbed off on the music too much. So we just felt, well, on the flip side of that, if we kind of go back to Cardiff and record in this studio that we've used for demos and stuff, it should be the flip side effect, the surroundings of this studio in Cardiff definitely had something in common with some of the lyrical nature of the album.
I can't explain it, but it was shit. We didn't even have a black and white telly, there was no distractions at all.
We were trying to reaffirm our existence as a band in a strange way. We were trying to kind of get back to a lot of reasons why we started the band.
Sean Moore.
We felt we were going a little bit astray with Gold Against the Soul. But we just needed to get back to sort of the basics and back to our grassroots of where we came from.
Some of the lyrics were very much more personal, and I felt as if sometimes perhaps I was definitely inhabiting somebody else's persona, somebody else's skin when I was singing these lyrics, especially songs like Faster.
I hate purity. I hate goodness. I don't want virtue to exist anywhere. I want everyone corrupt.
Thank you.
drummer Sean Moore.
He seemed quite happy, but whether it was because he'd found a solution, I don't know. But he seemed quite happy, you know, like just another day.
As time goes by, I realise just much more tougher and committed to his art than I ever realised. Just too much, so that's what destroyed him, I think.
The day kind of Richie went missing, huge part of our kind of rock and roll died.
I think it's the most our most definitive period. We've never been scared to admit that, you know. And we've never been scared to admit that, you know, since, you know, Richie hasn't been with us.
Richard disappeared on the 1st of February 1995. 2 weeks later, his car was found abandoned near the old Severn Bridge. He was 27.
Mystery still surrounds the disappearance of Manic Street Preachers guitarist Richie Edwards, whose car was found abandoned at the Severn Bridge on Friday. Tomorrow, it'll be 3 weeks since he disappeared from a hotel in London. Detective Inspector Frank Stockholm of South Wales Police this afternoon made a fresh appeal for information.
We're checking with friends, relatives, people that might know him. We've examined the vehicle to see if there was any evidence in the vehicle of where he might have gone. We're doing checks to see if his bank account is being used. We have checked with coroner officers either side of the Severn Estuary and the Bristol Channel, and that is negative at the present time.
What do you think might have happened to him?
We're keeping a very open mind. We're always positive. The service is at the Severn Bridge, situated not many miles away from the junction with the M5. If he was picked up from there or the Thunderlift, he could have gone anywhere.
The Holy Bible remains an overwhelming tour de force and tour of Richie's psyche, exploring topics like anorexia, mass murder, sexual exploitation, serial killers, and all different kinds of suffering. The music and the lyrics marry perfectly to create one of the most relentlessly oppressive albums I've ever heard. Music about mental anguish and torment had probably never sold as many records before.
The Holy Bible's a rock record and a history lesson. It's actually the sound of a band who've lost all faith in humanity. It was a doomsday judgment and a kind of cold-eyed tally of the 20th century's worst sins.
It's, you know, it's a 45-minute or 50-minute rock record, but it's a whole day's worth of the library, you know? And that, again, is commendable, especially at the climate of the times in 1994, when there was a certain yearning for escape, I believe. And here come the Manic Street Preachers with a record that challenges people's intelligence.
Singer James Dean Bradfield.
I wouldn't kind of like say it's our most classic or whatever you want to fucking say. You know, I can't think like that. But it is an album that represents a quite fraught but also a quite happy time in our lives. You know, we knew that we were making something special, and you don't get that feeling much sometimes. And sometimes, subsequently, you do end up doing something special, but you don't feel it at that moment in time. But with the Bible, you know, we actually felt that it was important. We felt that everything was at stake, and that we had, well, nothing to lose, because we felt like we were abandoned, that had failed somewhat at that point, you know, by not selling 27 million records and splitting up and all that kind of bollocks. And so kind of it was a moment in time, and obviously Richie was kind of like, you know, he wasn't in such bad shape when we were making that record. He was at the calm before the storm. But like, we felt that things were changing. So like, everything is indelibly etched in our hearts and in our minds, and in the music, you know, that you hear. So it's a time that I vividly remember, more so than any other time in the band, except for the very start, you know. It is just like indelibly etched on our souls. So kind of like, in a sense, it is an album that I can still smell, I can still hear it, I can still see the places we recorded it in, and that makes it special in its own way, I think.
In his last interview, he told a reporter from a Japanese music magazine, "I have no regrets. Regrets are meaningless. You can't change yesterday or tomorrow. You can change only this present moment."
How do you feel about the future with Manic Street Preachers?
Future? It's a big nasty word, isn't it?
Dear Stephen Moore has been leading the search for Richie James Edwards. There have been a number of clues, but nothing solid.
It is surprising with somebody of that stature that we've not had more concrete leads to pursue. I have to say that I am gravely concerned, and I
personally feel that Richie may no longer be with us?
Personally, I think he's gone abroad somewhere. I don't think he's committed suicide. He had too much intelligence to do that.
He's away somewhere. I don't think he's dead.
I don't think he's committed suicide because Ian just enjoys writing the lyrics too much and living, I'd say. I'm sure he enjoys living deep down.
Here's Richie's sister, Rachel Elias.
As families of missing people, all you're left with is your imagination about where they are, and that can be your best friend and your worst nightmare as well. It can take you to hopeful places, but places of real darkness. I like to think that one day we will know, and I haven't lost hope in knowing either way where he is, and I hold on to that.
In the United States, the number for the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is 988. On November 24th, 2008, Richie Edwards was declared presumed dead. You can find links to all the original audio sources in the show's notes. The songs you heard during this podcast were Yes, 4 Stone 7 Pounds, If White America Told the Truth for One Day Its World Would Collapse, and Faster. All of these songs could be found on the Manic Street Preachers album, The Holy Bible. You can stream The Holy Bible and the rest of the Manics catalog wherever you stream your favorite music. Our theme song is Rocket Sled by Blip. Special thanks to Jeff Calhoun. Abandoned Albums was recorded at Thunder Love Studios.
Produced and written by Keith R. Higgins.
Engineered and mixed by Steve Beasley, with help from Mike Hunt. Edited by A.J. Royce.
Original music by Mike Pellegrino.
If you like what you've heard, please be sure to subscribe and leave us a rating. It really does help. Thanks for listening.
At Twitter, we are at Abandoned Albums, and on Instagram, we are at Abandoned_Albums.
Grazie.
Bailey Leaf, Rob Janicki, S.W. Loudon, Michael Janicki, Steve Beasley, Mike Pellegrino, Therina Bella, Peyton Janicki, and of course, our executive producer.
This is Thunder Love.
And now, until we meet again next time,
I remain as always obediently yours.
Abandoned Albums is a production of Pawprint Media.